So take a 1949 Hudson Commodore that's been returned to a functional state, then plot a course across America, keeping in mind that her headlights aren't strong enough for night driving. She requires an oil change every 1,500 miles, gets only 13.5 miles to the gallon, and doesn't do well in heavy traffic. Now ask why anyone would set off on such a journey. We're about to find out as our next guests are here. They are Eileen Cho. She's senior editor of transportation projects for the Engineering News Record and ENR.com. Eileen, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dan McNichol's also here. He's an author and journalist whose work focuses on mega construction projects in the U.S. and around the world. Dan, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So, Eileen, the metaphor here, old car, old infrastructure, you've seen both up close and personal. Which one's in worse shape?
Actually, I think the way Dan takes care of Mrs. Hudson is head and shoulders beyond the way we as Americans are taking care of our infrastructure.
So the infrastructures are in worse shape.
I would think so.
You second that idea, Dan?
I do.
Yeah.
Barely.
Yeah. So the point of taking this 49 Hudson across the country is what? What are you trying to do here?
It's a rolling metaphor saying our bridges, our schools, our parks, our levees, our everything that's built is as rough and rusty as this 1949 Hudson.
Mm-hmm. And so you're driving across the country to say what to people?
To prove a point that getting this car across the country is unnecessarily difficult. We could drive in a new car, but we choose to not invest in infrastructure. We choose to use old systems beyond their life. And as a result, we have a drag on our economy, drag on our quality of life.
And Eileen, you're speaking, you're sitting in a state that's struggling over transportation funding right now. $0.02 a gallon gas tax, fuel tax increase just rejected by the General Assembly. The worst funding outlook for the highways in this state that we've seen in a long, long time.
In fact, yesterday, a MoDOT engineer, Greg Horn, rode with us for a little while. And he is at the end of his career. He should have retired, but engineers tend to keep working because they love their jobs. And he said that in all his career as an engineer, he's never been so concerned about the situation. He says that if things keep up the way they are, MoDOT is literally going to have to basically neglect a decent portion of their road system.
It's a breathtaking change after years of well-funded highways and roads. So what are you seeing out there, Dan? Just what's it look like as you get across the country? Give us a highlight of some of the lowlights, I guess, that you're seeing out there.
Sure. It looks like you might imagine if you got up close, like my rear quarter panel is rusty. The bridges are in horrible condition. And everyone sees bridges and roads. They travel over them. But what they don't see are weak levees. What they don't see are dams that are dangerous. You know, they're fracture critical by their nature, but there are no flood plans for when they do give, if they do give.
Even when it's raining so much in so many parts of the country right now.
It's an excellent point. Mm-hmm. And flood season, we were on the Mississippi River underneath the St. Louis Arch looking at what the National Park Service is doing for the Gateway Arch project. But it's sad to think that our commerce has slowed. And I think two things are happening, Steve. People around the world are increasing their investments in infrastructure. Their economies are heating up. And we are at the exact same time divesting and letting our systems decay. So we have this rise of the rest and our own demise. And simultaneously, we've dropped 16 categories, 16 levels in the World Economic Forum's ranking on infrastructure. America was number one 10 years ago, and we're now beyond 16.
And your theory as to why we're doing this, why we're taking the path we are, Dan, is what?
An ignorance of how fast the rest of the world is accelerating, and we're kind of okay with everything. It's working, like my car. We're getting across the country. It's just taking an enormous toll on me financially, time-wise, cost, frustration, and it's unnecessary.
So, Eileen, what would you like to see happen? What needs to happen here?
Well, first of all, and I think everyone in my world, the transportation industry, the engineers, the contractors, Republican, Democrat, in between, everyone agrees that to not index the federal gas tax to inflation for almost 20 years now, when that is the primary source of funding infrastructure, is kind of ridiculous. And even if we don't continue with the highway gas tax as the main form of funding, we have to do something. There has to be a vehicles model traveled, user fee. I mean, you have to pay for what you use.
I was going to say the gas tax is outmoded in at least a lot of people's minds because gas mileage standards are going up and the gas tax isn't quite as useful as it used to be. So what should it be? What's your view in terms of what should replace it? What should be the alternative?
Well, I believe Oregon is pushing forward with their own version of a vehicle miles traveled technology. There's also
you drive
tolls.
So many miles, you pay for those miles you drive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I know that states are taking matters into their own hands out of sheer desperation. And a lot of states have actually raised sales taxes or gas taxes. Voters have approved this because a lot of voters do realize that we need to invest in our own infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a tax isn't bad if you know what it's doing, if you know what it's going for. You know, we're in such an anti-tax environment, but again, you have to pay for what you use.
Are there some states that are generally regarded as being in pretty good shape compared to the rest of them?
I don't think any state DOT is going to tell you they're all hunky-dory.
Well, and that's one of the issues here, right? Because
right.
DOTs always want more money.
Sure.
They'll take whatever they can get.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the needs are real. I don't have the latest facts and figures over what states have the best percentage of, say, bridges that are not structurally deficient or functionally obsolete. But I would say that every state thinks that they could use more.
Dan, was there one state or another that you've driven through that you thought maybe was better than the other states just in terms of the quality of the roadways, the quality of the bridges?
It's interesting. Up in the northeast where I come from, Vermont is an excellent state that keeps their road systems looking good. You cross over the border to New Hampshire, you notice the difference right away. California is very advanced, and they're building their own systems. They did their own mega project, the Bay Bridge, the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, a $7 billion project. Only $300 million of it was federal. They take on initiatives like the high-speed rail line they're talking about and actually breaking ground on. But it's as Eileen was saying, they're all in desperate shape. There's a $500 billion deficit. For all the progress California's making, there's a $500 billion need. So, yes, they do grab everything they can get because they're pretty desperate for funding. And like Eileen was saying about Greg, here's this accomplished engineer, a go-to guy, and you could see it in his face. It really pains him to think that all this investment, all these roads, they're going to cut way back on the maintenance, and that means the demise of the road eventually. It's inevitable.
We're sitting here having a conversation about the quality of highways and bridges, which refers to the automobile and trucks and getting around that way. You just mentioned the high-speed train project in California. President Obama has talked about a bullet train kind of concept across the country. Where is that standing right now?
It's in the slow lane, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Having traveled to China extensively, I marvel at their system, the largest high-speed rail system in the world. Europe has it. Japan has it. All the developed nations have these systems, and it's critical for us to develop these systems. It will create an industry. It'll accelerate global transport. We'll become a much more attractive market locally, domestically, internationally.
Eileen, it's so important, but we're not building it. We're in the slow lane, to borrow Dan's words. Why is that?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the climate of the politics of the time. When I first started covering transportation for ENR almost 20 years ago, you know, transportation was something that in Congress was very nonpartisan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you had Republicans sponsoring six-year transportation funding bills. You know, it was that one issue, if nothing else, that both sides of the aisle could agree on. And unfortunately, I don't see that happening today.
Let's go to some phone calls. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. John from Brookside. John, you're on the show. Good morning.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Could your guest divulge their who do each of your guests work for? Like, for instance, who are the contributors to the associations that they work for? Because this conversation, while is necessary, seems to be tilted towards construction and engineering and just vested interest that would definitely benefit from, you know, a large influx of capital.
John, thanks. Eileen Cho, tell us who you work for and give us a sense of that.
Oh, okay. I work for Engineering News Record Magazine. It is the premier magazine for the construction industry. We are often told we're the Bible of the industry.
And they favor more construction, obviously.
Construction, civil engineering, design, every aspect of infrastructure is what we cover.
Dan, how about you?
I'm an independent author, journalist. I have my own business called Big Dig Productions, but I am I'm a student of the trades, fascinated by them, but believe earnestly that investment, like China's investment in its infrastructure, raised a half a billion people above the poverty line, that these investments that are construction and engineering oriented give back to society and create some
equilibrium. Are you being sponsored by interests that might benefit from more construction across the country?
On this tour, we are sponsored by the American Public Works Association, all the DPWs across America, and Case Construction Equipment. They are a heavy equipment manufacturer.
So again, groups that clearly want to benefit from more construction.
Absolutely. And okay. What we're trying to do is get beyond the echo chamber that is the construction and engineering industry and reach out to the public.
So how did you two get together for this road trip across the country? How did that happen, Eileen?
Well, a few months ago, I embarked on a feature story for ENR on legacies of mega projects. Mm-hmm. How a lot of mega projects are vilified in the present time because they're perceived as being white elephants, the cost overruns, et cetera. But in the long term, projects like the Big Dig or the Bay Bridge benefit the next generation in economic development and spur all sorts of, you know, long-term benefits that we don't see mm-hmm. up close. So Bart Ney, who used to be the spokesperson for the Bay Bridge, knows Dan, and I was and Bart was the one who put the bug in my ear to write the story. It's like, Eileen, you have to write the story. You have to write the story. Oh, by the way, my friend Dan drove across the country for this because Dan's done this before. Oh, I have to interview him. Hmm. And I thought it'd be a 20-minute interview. It was like 2 hours. By the end of the interview, Dan was inviting me to drive across the country.
You call your car Mrs. Martin. Why?
The original owner, the only other owner besides myself and my partner, Per Christensen, was named Mrs. Martin. And she was a tough woman who bought the car brand new in 1949. Her husband was like, why? All these roads up here in upstate New York are muddy. And he ended up falling in love with the car, according to the family, and they got into lots of arguments about it. She put it into the barn in 1956, swearing no one would ever drive it again until she died, and she lived to be about 100. And I bought it in 2011 with 31,000 miles on it.
Matthew called in to ask Eileen to talk more about how the use tax would work. The miles traveled idea, and you'd be taxed on how much you drive.
Right. Well, from what I remember of Oregon's experiment, I mean, basically, when you drive, you have GPS, you have all these systems. In this day and age, you're basically recording your mileage anyway, right? They would basically charge you by the mile that you drive a certain amount of a vehicle's mile traveled fee. Mm-hmm. So if you drove 80 miles in a week, you would pay yay dollars per mile.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't drive so much, you wouldn't get find as much. Not
maybe
fine,
maybe
that's
pennies
not the right
per
way.
Mile or
right.
less.
Yeah. You know, one of the reasons for this trip is to get the attention of Congress. How have you accomplished that, and what message do you hope to convey to them, Dan, as you make your way around here?
You know, we reluctantly agreed to launch out of Washington, D.C., and I say reluctantly because as a White House appointee, I was at the Department of Transportation and saw the inside of sausage making, as you might want to call it. And to me, it's much more important to get out. And to answer your question specifically, I think our goal and our intent is to get out of the echo chamber that is Washington and start talking to people locally. States are becoming much more responsible for their own infrastructure, and that means stepping into these big projects themselves without the federal backing they've had, but bringing the infrastructure issue to the local population and making them more aware of their surroundings, their built environment, we hope will stir Congress, stir federal investment again in these vital projects.
Have you had a chance to speak to Missouri lawmakers who, again, are struggling so much with the idea of transportation funding these days? And what are they telling you, if you have?
No, I have not spoken to any Missouri lawmakers on this trip. In the past, I have. And, you know, Steve, I would say it's the same everywhere in America where all infrastructure is local. And when they embrace what their challenges are, they take initiatives, and those initiatives look like either a small dam project in Wisconsin where the town decided to raise their own $10 million to fix the dam, or it's a state initiative like in Texas. They decided to tax themselves, and Proposition 1 passed back in November of 2014 to put permanently, constitutionally, put about $1 billion plus into transportation. That means light rail, heavy rail, roads, bridges. And it's these initiatives that you see more and more of. And they look like propositions often.
To what extent is Congress gun-shy, Eileen, to go ahead and take on a massive project like a bullet train across the country, maybe in the wake of the Affordable Care Act, a massive government program that very controversial in the country? Is that slowing things down here in terms of getting the idea of a bullet train off the ground?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Again, as I was saying before, we have such a contentious political climate right now. I mean, you can merit the debates of high-speed rail, but I don't think it's as simple as that. I think there's just this larger, nasty, you know, inherently battling atmosphere in Congress, be it Affordable Care Act, be it a high-speed train program, anything. And like I said, you know, this is distressing because back in the day, transportation was pretty much not Democratic or Republican. It was recognized as a necessary thing.
But not anymore.
Not anymore.
Not like everything else. Everything's controversial.
Everything's up for
partisan.
Debate,
yeah.
Almost beyond the point of productivity.
Well, Dan, you guys were hoping to stop and tour the streetcar project here in Kansas City. Have you had a chance to do that yet?
No, and I'm dying to, because in St. Louis, when we got to the front desk of the hotel, a millennial took us in and was talking all about the Metrolink and all about the rail lines. I love that millennial energy that's saying we need some other alternative modes to get around town.
Who are some of the more interesting characters you've met on the road since you've been gone? Who have you met out there that sort of caught your attention, Eileen?
You know, Dan's more used to this than I am. This is my first time driving in Mrs. Martin or riding in Mrs. Martin, but every time we stop at a gas station, you just get everything from, like, Hell's Angels to your average Joe. One of the interesting people
are just interested in old cars like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they really are. It's really it's there's something appealing. There's something that draws people. And there's this one fellow, and I actually quoted in my latest story for ENR. Just your regular Joe from Jefferson, Indianapolis, or in Indiana. I'm sorry. Just this regular nice guy. And I said to him, "What do you think about the symbol of the car as representing America's infrastructure?" And he said, "I think about it every time I cross a bridge." He said, I'm scared. It's
and then
scary.
His wife yelled at him, "Daryl, get over here. We have to go to the wedding."
Yeah.
But he actually said he's scared to drive across a bridge.
Yeah. I think he saw the 60 Minutes episode that aired a few months ago on infrastructure.
Yeah.
And it's nice to see that the message is getting out there in multiple venues.
Well, speaking of bridges in Missouri, of the 10,400 bridges in the state, MoDOT says 2,000, one in five roughly, are structurally deficient and functionally obsolete. Some are being closed. The department has estimated it'll take $5 billion to replace all of Missouri's deficient bridges. Maybe that's what's scaring people away ultimately here, Dan, this notion that these costs come with bees attached to them for billions of dollars, and bullet trains and fixing up bridges and highways, we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars. And no one wants to face it.
No one wants to face it, and it's inevitable. It's going to be billions and trillions, and we can afford it. It's just a matter of choosing to afford it, understanding why we're going to choose to afford it. In Pennsylvania—
But some might argue with that. Can we afford it at a time when our deficits are what they are in this country?
It's a choice. Mm-hmm. Where are you going to make the investment?
Well, again, some folks, there is no choice. We've already spent the money. We can't spend any more.
There's more to be had. There's more to be spent. And if we don't spend it, we will continue to see a slowing down of our economy and our losing of abilities to compete, to just increase the quality of life. And that means, I mean, infrastructure is everything. And I'm not advocating for any particular source. I'm advocating for it all. Because if you look at the entire infrastructure net, from grids to airports to dams to parks to schools, it's about healthcare, it's about education, it's about a quality of life and national security.
Where are you going after this? Where's next?
Where's next? We're actually supposed to have lunch with the chairman of the Department of Transportation.
Wow.
And then we're going to visit a bridge somewhere in the state. It's been
one
very,
10,
very whirlwind.
Yeah.
But a bridge that exemplifies how, even for a small community, and I've seen this in my coverage, even if it's a community of 3,000 people, that one bridge is a lifeline.
Eileen Cho is Senior Editor of Transportation Projects for the Engineering News Record and ENR.com. Dan McNichols, an author and journalist whose work focuses on mega construction projects around the country. Thank you both. Travel safe. Nice to have you here.
Thank
Great
you.
To be here.